We've got our friends at CNN here. You guys love breaking news, and you did it. You broke it. I think what no one in this room wants to admit is that Trump has helped all of you. He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric, but he has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him.
We're with you, Michelle Wolf, but if corporate media has got you down, maybe you should try WBAI. We're listener-supported community radio, questioning the mainstream narratives trumpeted by the news profiteers. But in order for this whole thing to work, we need your help. Please go to give2wbai.org to find out how you can support WBAI or call 516-620-3602. And thanks for supporting Free Speech Radio on WBAI New York.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York, where the time is just about 8 o'clock. Time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Alex.
Howdy.
And Kyle.
Hiya.
Well, what a day. I guess you'd call today a good day for democracy, would you not?
I don't know. It's kind of. I thought it was kind of a slow news week. Has something been going on?
A lot's been going on, Rob. Yeah, I'll let you read up on the website there.
Pay attention to the show tonight.
Yeah, if you listen to the show, maybe you'll catch up on some of the things.
There might be bits and pieces of.
Yeah, it's well, our president learned a new phrase, which is always a good thing for all of us. He learned quid pro quo. That's it. Quid pro quo. Yes. That is, now, Alex, you're a lawyer.
Yes.
What does that mean? He keeps saying it in tweets
constantly.
It's no longer collusion. He's discarded that word and replaced it with
collusion.
He's saying no quid pro quo. I don't think he knows what it means.
Yes. Well, it's the Latin for this for that, actually.
Know this for that is what he's saying.
Yeah, I mean the pro, I believe takes the ablative form of the noun, so I think that would go with the quo. But quid and quo are essentially the same thing, so it's like a this for that type of situation.
But this is not that.
It could be, but in this situation, it isn't.
Right. This is the opposite. It could be the opposite of that.
It could be that for this.
It's like this and like that.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Which he's also accused of, by the way.
Well, yes, among other things this week.
Well, it has not been a good day for the current administration. And we're going to focus on some of the technical aspects of that, as we are prone to do. But you were going to tell us something about the whole whistleblower process, I guess, because you have someone... You had some experience with this, I believe?
I did, yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, when I was chief compliance officer of a very big luxury conglomerate.
You're chief compliance officer.
I was, if you can believe that. Yes,
I
was.
Can't believe that.
I was a chief of many things.
You're usually the person that's not complying.
You know, some might say that. It depends on whatever we are supposed to be complying with, I guess.
Chief compliance. That means there's many compliance officers? Or,
there were many compliance officers around the world, but then I was the chief compliance officer.
Wow.
But I focus mostly on legal issues and things.
I am sufficiently intimidated.
You should be, because you are, if nothing else, non-compliant.
Yeah, I've been told that yes. On a number of occasions, and I have several letters.
To non-conforming. You should try something new one day and conform.
I don't know. I think it's too late for me. Anyway, so what were your responsibilities?
Well, you know, among other things, I actually ran the worldwide whistleblowing line. And we had about 30,000 employees, you know, scattered.
You mean you ran the world? Every whistleblower came through you? Or what?
Yeah, every whistleblowing complaint came through me.
But for who? For what agency or?
For any of the companies that the conglomerate for which I used to work owned.
Okay.
So if they made a complaint about fraud, waste, abuse, things like that, then it would go to the whistleblowing line or retaliation.
We're not going to mention the conglomerate, I take it.
No, we don't have to. I don't think
so. Okay, let's not do that.
People can look it up.
People can use their imagination.
They can use their imagination,
as bad as you think it is, it's worse.
Yeah, it was in fashion and things. And so... but, you know, these things are very important in a corporate setting, but also very important in a governmental
setting.
Hang
on, I just have to interrupt you one more time. Kyle's got a whistle, and he's going to blow it. That, friends, is an authentic Captain Crunch whistle. dug out of a 1960s cereal box and used to route phone calls for many decades until they fixed the whole system. But, Kyle, you would not have gotten much from that, because that's not a 2600 hertz tone that you just blew. I don't think it was.
No.
You want to blow a little harder and maybe a little further away from the microphone, too, so we don't have to replace them. Good Lord. I think you've gotten the attention of everybody in the building, but no free phone calls, I'm afraid.
I think this this was actually 3D printed, so.
Are you kidding me? That's not even authentic. It looks so authentic. That's not authentic?
Yeah, this was actually given to me by our cover artist.
Can I drop it on the table or will it break?
You can. It's very durable.
Well, it doesn't bounce. Hold on. Let me try it again. Wow. Yeah, you could have fooled me. These are modeled, I guess, on the authentic Captain Crunch whistles. That 2600 is pretty much kind of named after.
That's right. This was a toy included with cereal that emitted that tone.
Yeah,
so,
named after
the
frequency, not necessarily
the
whistle.
We've had a whistleblowing on the show now.
All right,
so
now
we're ready for this.
Blown
part.
The damn whistle. So yes, Rob.
And for those interested, I believe that 3D model file is available on repositories of free 3D model files. If you'd like to have one for yourself and you're into 3D printing,
for all the good it'll do you.
So you fielded calls and submissions to this mechanism within this conglomerate.
That's correct. Yes. And just as an aside, I do have to say and comment on this whole whistleblowing fiasco here. I mean, live whistleblowing. You guys have been planning this for years, it seems like, just waiting for the right moment.
We've had that thing in our pockets
at all times.
At any moment, you know, there could be. So congratulations on finally getting that done.
This, I think, is the week of the whistleblower. Coin a phrase.
I felt compelled to, you know, express myself in that way, especially given the topic at hand.
Yeah, and I'm glad you surprised me with it, too. Because
I'm sorry for that.
Kyle, a sealed indictment and two men waiting for you out in the hallway now.
Okay.
That's true.
So, all right. You know, we deal with that, and we'll get on with the show.
I accept the consequences. I'm sorry for the terrible joke.
I know,
Alex,
a good
lawyer. Back to your history.
Ran the worldwide whistleblowing line, so any complaints about, you know, business practices, fraud, things like that would come to me. And then we would investigate the complaint, we would determine whether or not there is, you know, merit to the complaint, we'd write a report about this particular complaint, and interestingly enough, you know, when you file a whistleblower complaint, you become protected from retaliation. And certain countries have different laws about confidentiality in whistleblowing. You know, the EU is much more private about these things. And confidentiality, even in the United States, has to be, you know, very much safeguarded. However, it's not always possible to safeguard the confidentiality of a whistleblower, because the specific allegations that a whistleblower makes may give enough information to a third party for them to identify that person by name or function or to a small subset of people, something like that. You know, and sometimes these whistleblowing lines can be misused, especially if an employee feels as if they might be on the chopping block and they make a whistleblowing disclosure, and then they become sort of protected from retaliation. It becomes very difficult to terminate an employee who's made a whistleblowing complaint because it can look like retaliation. And, you know, this isn't a corporate setting, but whistleblowing in the federal setting is very similar in the way in which it's structured. And, you know, whistleblowing disclosures can save lives as well as billions of taxpayer dollars. They play a critical role in keeping our government honest, efficient, and accountable, recognizing that whistleblowers root out waste, fraud, and abuse and protect public health and safety. Federal laws strongly encourage employees to disclose wrongdoing. Federal laws also protect federal employees from retaliation. I was just reading from the Know Your Rights When Reporting Wrongs sheet from the Office of Special Counsel, which is an independent federal agency that is, or rather was, created, I believe, in around 1979, specifically for the purpose of people reporting wrongdoing in the federal government. And there are two other outlets to report wrongdoing in the federal government. Most every federal agency and even sub-agencies of federal agencies will have, depending upon how many employees they have, OIGs, or Offices of Inspector Generals. And the Inspector General's charge in every one of these agencies is to deal with these types of whistleblowing complaints and look for FWA, fraud, waste, and abuse. Fraud being perpetrated on the government, you know, double billing, triple invoices, cost inflation, things like that, waste of federal resources, and, you know, thirdly, and I think most importantly for today's conversation, abuse. What is abuse? Abuse could mean, abusing your gas privileges, abusing your per diem privileges, or could potentially amount to an abuse of authority of a federal position, perhaps engaging in things like quid pro quos for a benefit to yourself or to others. And so that's the three different outlets for a federal whistleblower to go to. Things get a little bit more complicated, though, when you are a federal employee working in a classified environment, because you can't just call up the whistleblower hotline. You can't just, go to your inspector general. If you are working in a classified environment, and let's say you're dealing with information that may be at the TSSCI level, the top secret sensitive compartmented information level, you have to be extraordinarily careful about how you blow the whistle, unlike Kyle, who just, blows whistles willy-nilly or in radio stations.
He's still out in the hallway, so we can't talk about him while he's still being questioned.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. And so it's a little bit trickier because you have to make sure that if you are going to make a whistleblowing complaint that involves classified information, that you give it to a person who would also be able to have access to that information. So you may want to call the Office of Special Counsel and coordinate your whistleblowing disclosure so that it can be made to a proper party who has the right authorization to actually receive that information.
So now, is that what happened in the case everybody's talking about now with the president?
Quite likely. I think that's what happened.
Okay.
Because he went to the Office of an Inspector General, and we know that based on the transcription of the telephone call that was released earlier today, that this was
that it was urgent. Was that the statement that? Well, you're talking about the transcript of the call. The person that this complaint was, the complaint part was submitted to. That I think is important to kind of clarify where in that chain of declaration of making this statement, where they then were making the public aware, or where their assessment of it being urgent, how that escalated through the House and judiciary and oversight in the House. I think that's an interesting curious given what you're describing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, because what will happen is, you know, the Office of Inspector General probably received this complaint. They had to investigate it. They saw that this was, you know, somewhat urgent and really pressing, and it had to deal with the President of the United States, so obviously politically charged as well. So they investigated this and came up with a report. And then obviously that report was what was withheld from Congress until just, you know, an hour and a half ago,
yeah,
or 2 hours.
Yeah, actually, it is happening. They're reading it as we speak. It was illegal for them to not provide it, correct?
Yes, they're supposed to provide it by statute to Congress, to members of Congress who are authorized to receive it.
That's the complaint itself. The transcript was then offered once this began to become a possibility. I think the White House then released the transcript, if I'm correct.
The transcript was released this morning, and it was supposed to exonerate Trump, and it certainly didn't.
Well, that's right. And I mean, it's bizarre to me that he had thought about that. But so,
yeah, well, it's not bizarre to me. You know why? Because he didn't think what he did was wrong. That's the key thing here. He thinks his way of dealing with people and pressuring them and intimidating them, he can get away with. And obviously he can't. Now he's learning that. And it's a little bit too late.
The rules don't apply. That attitude.
Well, guess what? They do. They do sometimes. And finally, we're seeing some changes. That's why I say it's a good day for democracy. Not only did Parliament reconvene in England because of their Supreme Court, which ruled unanimously that Boris Johnson broke the law in dissolving Parliament, but now we have this. It's almost like the dawning of a new era.
Yes. But back to this particular transcript, mm-hmm. though. And, you know, and I appreciate your reference to 70s music and things like that, but
it's,
you know,
actually
80s.
Was it? The Specials came out, well, you know what, it might be the late 70s, you know. Now I have to look it up.
Yeah, dawning of a new, yeah, okay, yeah. I was, you're right, it is the Specials. I was thinking of the Aquarius thing, but
well,
yeah,
the version we played last night was actually the Coventry Automatics, which was the Specials' name before they became the Specials.
Wow. Oh,
that's okay. A little bit of trivia there and a bonus bit of information for Off the Hook listeners.
Wow. We are just full of digressions this evening. And
we're full of something.
Yeah, that's true. But to go back to Kyle's original question here, which is, you know, the information that we're dealing with was of a classified nature, which means that it would have to have been provided to people who were authorized to receive it in order for the whistleblower not to be then prosecuted for the disclosure of classified information to a person who wasn't authorized to receive it. And we know that it's classified because what was released, was marked as, you know, unclassified at the top, and you have all the hallmarks of classified documents. When you actually look at the document itself, it was classified at the secret level, and it was compartmentalized. It had ORCON and no foreign written at the bottom of the document.
It said for no eyes or don't copy or something like that as well? Or?
Yeah, eyes only, do not copy.
But it's unclassified.
Now it's unclassified.
Okay, so that's a new stamp they put on it.
That's right.
Got
so
it.
Now it's unclassified.
They strike through the previous classification so you can reference what it was prior to being unclassified.
Yes, and there's something interesting about this previous classification because you don't very often see this. You don't see one of these tags. No foreign is very common. Yeah, having worked in classified environments, no foreign just basically means no foreigners are allowed to see this particular document, right? You know, even if they're allies and they might have clearance.
That's what they call it, no foreigns?
No foreign. That's what it says.
Are you saying foreign, or is it F-O-R-N or something?
F-O-R-N. It's N-O-F-O-R-N.
Really?
F-O-R-N. No foreign is the classification, and no foreigners are allowed to see that document.
I'm amazed that like white supremacists haven't seized upon that word as a way of referring derogatorily to foreign people.
Well, you are just full of ideas.
Foreign.
Tonight.
Yeah, I can just see it working for them.
Yeah, I believe it too.
Save that for Off the Xenophobia.
right. That's our Friday show. But
yeah,
okay, no
right.
Mind.
The other classification is ORCON, O-R-C-O-N, which
I haven't a clue.
which,
what's that
which
one?
Is pretty interesting, actually. It means originator controlled. And originator controlled means that whoever generated this document can track everybody to whom it has received it, everybody who has received this particular document.
Oh, my God. I read it this morning.
Yep. Well,
so
it's not classified anymore, but
oh,
you know, I'm sure that you know that POTUS is well aware of your reading habits. As a matter of fact, Emmanuel, but
he's
yeah.
not aware of his own reading habits.
Just to add a little bit, my understanding of the transcript is that it was aides, duty service officers, so guys that stand and open doors and stuff, their recollections. There's actually a preamble warning about this, but also, and I think mainly, the National Security Council was responsible, and I think a little bit of voice recognition was used from the audio parts, and then that combined with the contemporaneous notes of duty officers that were in the room is where this transcript was generated. So essentially, those who control this would either be National Security Council or White House or some combination of both, like cabinet.
Yeah, I think this would probably belong to the White House. And therefore, anybody who, you know, had access to this document or read it, or anybody to whom it was sent, you know, ORCON means that the originator of this document would then be able to get a list of everybody who had that document. And I think that's important for this particular document as well, because it is, when you read it, extraordinarily damning. I mean, there is a very obvious quid pro quo going on here. And so ORCON having been part of the classification here, I think is really quite telling. And I'm sure our listeners find it interesting as part of the technical components of this document.
But so does this ORCON status also mean that whoever originated this document has theoretically has the whistleblower on their list of people who've had custody of it?
Quite possibly, yes. Yes, in fact. However, it seems like the whistleblower might have been in the room. He might have had, you know, some other access to this as well.
Yeah, the transcript is not part of the complaint. It is, again, this is something the White House added, and what from all reports, it seems to have been a preemptive thing given the statement from the House Judiciary that they are going forward with a formal investigation or inquiry, whatever you want to call it, and that the White House did this. We're to believe them as to be upfront, or as you indicated, that they really don't believe there's anything there. I think a lot of the statements yesterday from minority representatives of the House was that, you know, be prepared to be underwhelmed. I think somebody said that in the media. And
I
so
said
on.
That last night. I thought it was going to be something that completely completely cleared Trump in most people's eyes, but it certainly didn't work that way.
So who is the originator
of this? It's difficult to say. You can't really tell exactly from the document itself. It says, you know, the note takers are the White House Situation Room. So we're not entirely sure of that. But so we know that, you know, there is a whistleblower. The complaint was made to an inspector general. I believe it was Department of Justice. And we know that we're dealing with classified information. So disclosures are by their nature very limited, or rather the recipients of these disclosures can be by their nature very limited to people who would have access to this type of classified information. But all this hubbub about Congress getting the document itself raises another issue here, and that's on the basis of, you know, what the Office of Special Counsel has released over to the public. If you read their documents here, I mean, let me read their actual words here. It says, you know, for whistleblower disclosures involving classified national security information or other information protected from public release by law, for example, patient privacy information, whistleblowers must use confidential channels, such as an IG, which stands for Inspector General, OSC, okay, which stands for the Office of Special Counsel, or Congress, in order to be protected from adverse personnel actions related to their disclosures. So that raises this really interesting issue. Is if Congress was jumping up and down about getting this report and getting the information, the whistleblower could have gone to either HPSI or CISI, which is the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, or the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, or any members thereof, to make the same disclosures, because they would, by their very nature, have the clearances that would authorize them to receive it. So, you know, I feel like we've been given the runaround here for quite a few days. And, you know, perhaps this whistleblower was reticent or reluctant to go directly to Congress because maybe it would seem to be too much of an overtly political act. But Congress is supposed to be a party to whom you can always go to. There's federal law protecting us. And the fact that we are so polarized as a nation, that it seems to foreclose Congress from being able to receive this anymore. And I think that that's an incredibly dangerous situation that we have on our hands now, because Congress is supposed to have an oversight function, not only of the federal agencies, you know, for which their committees have these responsibilities, but of the president himself. And this had to deal with the president. And I feel like this whistleblower was afraid to go to Congress specifically because it would be seen to be an overtly political act and would not be taken seriously, which is the complete opposite of the reasons why we have Congress available for whistleblowers.
Well, I mean, we have seen such an outpouring of support for Trump from the Republican side, saying that this is all made up, that the Democrats are just coming after him with absolutely no evidence, when clearly there is something here. Any legal expert will tell you this. But they are showing that no matter what happens, they are going to stand by him. In fact, I even saw one, I think this came from Trump himself, one tweet that said the lawyer of this whistleblower donated to Biden. And for some reason, that's supposed to be condemning information, but just shows you how low they will go to dig up anything that they can use to make it appear that the motivation here was not pure.
So I'm just curious what you think. What are whistleblowers left to do when this system breaks in this way? I mean, gosh, there seems like there's nowhere to go with this information.
Well, I mean, that's always been a problem with the federal government. That's why we've had, you know, whistleblowers going outside these channels for a number of years, and it's very, very difficult to navigate, especially when you're working in a classified environment, because disclosing this information outside of these proper channels can result in criminal action. But thankfully, there is still the Office of Special Counsel and the Inspector General's, and this Inspector General is taking this very seriously. But to Emmanuel's point, though, I do want to read something to you. I'm going to read to you a quote from an article today. And you can guess where this came from afterwards. I'm not going to tell you the source of this right now. But so, quote, and this is talking about the transcript that was released, quote, "The transcript provides proof that Trump made a completely improper request that the president of Ukraine work with Trump's personal counsel to investigate a political rival. It provides strong evidence that this took place in the context of a quid pro quo for desperately needed military aid." That's pretty strong condemnation right there. I mean, and I think that the facts of the transcription bear that out. Want to hazard a guess from what publication this came?
What publication?
Yes.
Came from a publication. Gosh. Commercial publication or
commercial
a government publication? Okay. Okay, yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb and say National Review.
You're absolutely right.
Really?
You are absolutely right. Did you see this?
No, I did not. I tried to think of a conservative publication that has some degree of integrity.
Yeah, David French wrote this in the National Review today. It was published at 2:43 p.m.
You know what I heard? I heard from I didn't hear directly from a senator, but I heard a senator tell a reporter. A senator told a reporter this. I don't know the names, but they said that 20... either 20 or 30 Republican senators would vote to impeach if it was an anonymous vote. And that tells you where we stand. That tells you where we stand.
Yep, just amazing.
So to Kyle's point, there are places that we can submit whistleblowing reports, right? I believe we even found a webpage here on osc.gov. OSC is what again?
The Office of Special Counsel, which is different from... you know, the special counsel that's appointed by the Department of Justice to investigate things.
But how is the Office of Special Counsel different from the special counsel?
Well, there's a special counsel that can be appointed by the Department of Justice to investigate certain things that there may be inherent biases, you know, with respect to, you know, maybe things like election interference and meddling and you know, et cetera.
It's the distinction between being able to convene a special counsel and then having a special counsel in-house.
Yeah, that's right. The Office of Special Counsel exists all the time. It's always there. They're always there for you. They're here to help whistleblowers and make disclosures, figure out how to do this in the best way possible.
But when one is convened, it's an independent special counsel, right, separate from this in-house.
That's correct.
Yeah,
absolutely.
This is as interesting as anything hacking related that we usually do, because there are just so many systems at work here and so many ways to route around them and break them and just use them in manners that they either were or were not intended to be used.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm learning so much just by listening to this. But okay, so we have this website open now, and I understand there are, can you explain what these numbers are that I'm seeing in front of me?
Yeah, there's one for PPP, which stands for Protected Personnel, I can't remember.
Practices.
So practices, right.
That's like reprisals?
That's exactly right.
From coworkers?
So let's say you're a whistleblower, you make a disclosure, and you can then not be subject to PPP, Protected Personnel, what was the last?
Prohibitive
prohibited personnel practices.
Prohibited personnel practices. Yeah. That's correct.
Right. I also see one below it, whistleblower disclosure hotline. Oh, you know what? The phone numbers are the same.
Yeah, they're the same. That's right. So the PPP applies if you're a whistleblower. You are entitled to not have retaliation been made against you. You can't have any adverse personnel actions made against you because you are a whistleblower. You have essentially a protected status. But, you know, there has to be a causal element here. If you're a terrible federal employee, you can still be fired independently because you're a terrible federal employee. But you can't be fired because you are a whistleblower. So you have to have that causal nexus to engage the PPP prohibition. I believe there's another phone number for the Hatch Act violations. The Hatch Act prohibits political activities of federal employees while they're on duty and on premises.
Wait. Isn't that not political activities? It prohibits commercial activities while serving in the office. Or am I thinking of something else?
Yeah, that might be something else, or there might be something under the Hatch Act.
That's emoluments, right?
That's emoluments. Okay. Emoluments.
All right. So, are we going to try and call one of these numbers or not?
Yes.
Should we do that?
Yeah. So the PPP number and the whistleblower number are the same number.
All right. We have a dial tone here. Should I call the 202 number or the 800 number? Does it matter?
No, they go to the same place.
Let's do the 202 number. And you can figure out what these numbers are, I guess. It's on a website, so I don't think I'm really revealing anything. All right, let's listen carefully. Okay, we have a ring. Hello? Is there anybody there?
Let it go.
Let it go. It answered.
I know.
Somebody listening without saying anything. That's kind of spooky a little bit. Hello, I'm a whistleblower here. I got something to say.
I have a feeling there's going to be something coming soon.
I hope so. I'd be losing patience now if...
You seem to be losing patience already. You would be losing patience.
Well, we're halfway through the show, and we're trying to whistleblow here, and
those
and
guys
nobody's
left.
Listening.
I can get my whistle again if you guys need
it. No, don't do that. Okay. Don't do that.
I'm just checking.
Let's listen without us talking and see if there's the sound.
No, something I think will change.
No, it's just complete silence.
Keep it going.
How long do you expect us to be connected to this? First of all, they can hear everything we're saying.
This happened earlier.
Uh-huh. You called this earlier. What happened?
I did. I got the same
you got
pause,
silence.
I got silence, and then I got hold music.
How long did you stay on for to get this?
For a while.
Okay, you know what? This is radio time in New York City. We don't really have
that
much.
It was about maybe a minute and a half, uh-huh. Something like that. Then I heard hold music. Hold music lasted approximately 1 minute.
Uh-huh. Okay, what's going on right now is there's a room full of men with all those military insignia on their jackets around the table, listening to us right now, deciding whether or not it's worth picking up the phone or sending a missile our way. I don't think we should give them the satisfaction. Why don't we move on?
Well, at least we know they're very good at transcription.
One of them's in a wheelchair, I know.
All right, fine. Fact. Good for them. But, you know, I'm going to call the 800 number and see. Maybe that was a fluke. I was hoping to actually reach a human being. Okay, that one didn't even ring. It just went right to silence. Wow.
Maybe their mailbox is full.
Hello, is there anybody there? Are you in trouble? Do you need help?
Blink
maybe
twice.
Maybe they're just overloaded. Okay, so this is what happens if you're a whistleblower and you try to call in, you get nothing. I guess there's nothing more symbolic than that.
So, yeah.
Well, and there's a number of these hotlines. Some of the hotlines have very terrible hours as well. For instance, I called one today that was open from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
What's wrong with that? That's a good time.
It's not. I mean, you would think that a whistleblowing hotline, you know, let me get this document out.
Okay,
let's go back to the Know Your Rights When Reporting Wrongs. Whistleblower, this is the words of the Office of Special Counsel. Whistleblower disclosures can save lives as well as billions of taxpayer dollars. You would think that there would be a hotline where somebody would be able to answer a phone, a human being, take a whistleblower complaint 24/7, or at least have voicemail.
Well, let's not forget, too, that in this situation, let's say we're hypothetically the whistleblower in the case at hand here, and this complaint is urgent and important, and I'm really, really concerned about declaring this to people with the appropriate level of clearance and so forth, and I'm getting nothing.
Yeah, well, it makes you think twice about whistleblowing in the first place.
You know, I know how much we all love telephones here, but is there perhaps alternatives to that available? Do they have email, secure drop, pigeons, anything?
Tweet. Yes, they do, yeah. In fact, if you're a whistleblower and you want to make a disclosure, you can always email info@osc.gov.
Okay, but you might get the same silence, except you wouldn't know you were getting silence.
Coincidentally, I did email earlier today a query to info@osc.gov.
And did you get anything back?
I did not.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I emailed them, I don't know, maybe it was 3:30, something like that. So I probably only had 30 minutes left in the federal workday. But, again, you would think that you would get some kind of response, something saying, we received your query, we're going to respond within X number of hours.
Or an automated reply.
Some kind of automated reply, something that just goes into the ether. You don't know if anybody's receiving it. And so it's sort of unnerving, too. Imagine being a whistleblower in a classified environment.
Well, wait a minute. I just thought, if you're a whistleblower in a classified environment and you emailed something, do you want email from the whistleblowing agency coming back to you?
Probably yeah. Not to your government account.
No.
And you certainly wouldn't want to put any classified information in that email because you could be breaking federal law in so doing. And that would be very, very bad. So even – and that's another important thing, too. If you – let's say you're in the intelligence community, you want to make a whistleblowing complaint, it's hard for you to use these hotlines even when they are open because you can't have a frank conversation with the person on the other end. You'll have to tell them, well, I work at this level of clearance. I need to talk to somebody. Maybe they'll get back to you, in a day or two, try to schedule something. But because of the classification of information, it can become very difficult to find the right people and do this in a timely fashion.
And since this all seems to be two-way communication that's needed, are you able to – is there any possibility of doing this with any type of anonymity?
Well, the Office of Special Counsel is supposed to safeguard your anonymity to the best of their ability.
Do they use secure drop?
I don't think they use secure drop. No, I do not. But in terms of, once the disclosure is made, you are entitled to confidentiality unless – certain exceptions apply, like there's a public health or safety exception. And just like corporate whistleblowing lines, they can't necessarily guarantee that anonymity because the specifics of whatever the allegation are may give rise to your identity. And I feel like that's the situation we're in today with Trump.
Yeah, that's a really good point because a lot of what can really outline your level of access, and just like browser fingerprinting can take certain details of the information you're divulging or details of your configuration, that can kind of paint a picture of you and to the point where it's unique enough to track much in the same way. I could see that working easily. If everything's need to know and someone knows what you know or you're divulging what you know in some way, and someone who knows only a select few people know these things, on and on it goes. You could deduce it depending on the sort of layers of access.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's what compartmentalization of information is designed to do, is to limit to a very small subset of people. So once you get higher than the top secret level and you get into SCI, sensitive compartmented information, it is by its nature, a very small subset of people that would have access to that.
I'd like to focus on another aspect to this story that we haven't mentioned so far. And this draws from a story from our friend Lorenzo over at Vice Motherboard titled, "What is CrowdStrike and why is Donald Trump blabbering about it to Ukraine?" and you might have noticed this. They released the transcript this morning between Donald Trump and Ukraine's President Zelensky. And in that call, Trump congratulates Zelensky for his victory in the elections. The two exchanged pleasantries. And then Trump said it would be great if the new Ukrainian president could help investigate Democratic presidential frontrunner Joe Biden and his son, who was on the board of an oil company in Ukraine. But that's not the only request for a favor Trump made. In a confusing ramble, Trump told Zelensky he'd like him to look into the server. And name-dropped CrowdStrike, the cybersecurity firm that investigated the hack on the Democratic National Committee in 2016. For what it's worth, people at CrowdStrike are as confused as we all are. I got nothing. Adam Myers, the vice president of intelligence at CrowdStrike, told me in an online chat when asked why Trump may have referred to the company in the call. A company spokesperson said they were working on an official response. My media monitoring tool has been blowing up, the spokesperson said in an email. In a statement sent to reporters, CrowdStrike said that with regards to our investigation of the DNC hack in 2016, we provided all forensic evidence and analysis to the FBI. As we stated before, we stand by our findings and conclusions that have been fully supported by the U.S. intelligence community and opposed by Trump. How Trump managed to remember the name CrowdStrike, which is mentioned only four times in the Mueller report, each in footnotes, is anyone's guess. And honestly, who knows what Trump is actually trying to say here? It's unclear why he believes Ukraine has the server and what server he's even talking about. Presumably, Trump is referring to the DNC server that's at the center of a conspiracy theory completely made up by Trump's imagination. No, perhaps he's thinking of Hillary Clinton's private email server. Where is the DNC server and why didn't the FBI take possession of it? Deep state, ? Trump tweeted last year. And according to this conspiracy, the FBI and CrowdStrike failed to seize a DNC server that supposedly holds important information related to the hack. In reality, there's no missing server, and both CrowdStrike and the U.S. government concluded that Russian government hackers broke into the DNC. In a 2017 interview with the Associated Press, Trump said CrowdStrike is Ukraine-based. Fact check, it's based in Sunnyvale, California, and has a big office in Arlington, Virginia, not currently part of Ukraine. That's what I heard, Trump said. I heard it's owned by a very rich Ukrainian. That's what I heard. So to recap, it seems that Trump is saying that CrowdStrike, an American company, is actually Ukrainian. That's why he's asking the new president of Ukraine, a former comedian, by the way, to help him find a missing server that actually does not exist. And for the record, CrowdStrike is a cybersecurity company that makes an antivirus-like product called Falcon. This is a cloud-based software that monitors computers and protects them from malware. The company also investigates data breaches when customers hire its researchers to respond to an incident. Brilliant story by our friend Lorenzo over at Vice Motherboard. But wow, that is something that a lot of people are talking about right now, especially in our community.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth reading Trump's actual words here on CrowdStrike. So, you know, something important to remember, too, is that this conversation happened one day after Robert Mueller testified before Congress. Remember the big hullabaloo about that? So prior to this statement, President Zelensky was saying to Trump that you know, they want more Javelin missiles from the United States for defense purposes. And those Javelin missiles are relevant for anti-tank operations with the Russians, sort of causes that allows them to hold the line.
That clears up some confusion because he said Javelins in the conversation. I was wondering why he wanted those. But okay, they're missiles.
Yeah. It's a shoulder-fired guided missile that's really easy to aim and fire.
Okay. That I didn't know, but now I do. So the president, in response, says this according to the transcript. Remember, this isn't exactly verbatim, but it's pretty damn verbatim, in my opinion. The president says this, quote, "I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike, ... I guess you have one of your wealthy people, ... The server, ... They say Ukraine has it. There are a lot of things that went on. The whole situation, I think you're surrounding yourself with some of the same people. I would like to have the Attorney General call you or your people, and I would like you to get to the bottom of it. As you saw yesterday," referring to the Mueller testimony, "that whole nonsense ended with a very poor performance by a man named Robert Mueller, an incompetent performance, but they say a lot of it started with Ukraine. Whatever you can do, it's very important that you do it, if that's possible."
And we'll have little Paulie and Big Tony come and talk to you later.
Yes, I mean.
Wow. I mean, this is like listening to an organized crime transcript. It really is, because it's not what's said directly. It's what's hinted at that, you know, you have to be pretty thick as a brick to not see.
It also seems like someone was telling the president this sort of parable, I don't know what, and then in order to manipulate him into making whatever kind of diplomatic or strategic move this call or this pressure would be, that's I think overly sinister, though. It seems more just foolish, especially the whole private attorney angle and all that, but go on.
Oh yeah, and then going further into the conversation is where the real quid pro quo comes up. And again, this is after they make the request for the javelins. And Trump says, the other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution. So if you can look into it, .. Sounds horrible to me.
And there's speculation as to what those dots mean. Does that mean that something is redacted? Does that mean that his voice trailed off into more confusing hints of something?
We don't know, but my guess, an educated guess based on lots of experience listening to the president, is that he just trailed off.
Mm-hmm,
it sounds like, you know, his thought process just...
It's stream of consciousness and not finishing a sentence or having incomplete sentences and many run-on sentences in his stream of consciousness.
I mean, it's like, you know, the audible version of Ulysses, you know, trying to follow a Donald Trump conversation, or maybe Finnegan's Wake, actually.
And interrupting yourself constantly, right? Yes.
Well, that's Biden's.
No, I was trying to think of who you had pointed
Listen
out.
Listen to Biden talk when he gets to the end of a sentence, and then all of a sudden he goes into another thought. He never finishes the sentence. But that's a
you know what
other.
I'm saying. But the point is that.
Well, the annoying thing is he's answering a question, and then he never gets to. You know what I'm talking about?
I mean,
he's
come on,
never finishes.
Come on, then, guys, we're better than this.
Kyle, stop rubbing my shoulders.
All right. Anyway, as if today wasn't Keystone Copish enough for you, get this. The White House sends some impeachment talking points to Democrats and then tried to recall them. I'm not exactly sure how you do that, but basically what happened was a White House official accidentally sent talking points for allies defending the president to Democratic officials and then tried to recall the memo. And in that email, the White House laid out guidance for how supporters should publicly discuss Trump's July phone call with President Zelensky of Ukraine. An allegation that Trump tried to use that conversation for political gain contributed to the decision by House Democrats yesterday to announce a formal impeachment inquiry. The White House list of concise points and counterpoints was also sent to the offices of Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democratic lawmakers. According to Representative Bill Pascrell Jr., Democrat of New Jersey, they're complete Orwellian lies and toxic trash, but maybe you'd like to read them to appreciate their corruption. And then he tweeted the whole thing to anyone who wanted to read them. And that, my friends, that is healthy. That is democracy in action. Wow. Representative Brendan Boyle, Democrat of Pennsylvania, said that his office had also received the email. I will not be using their spin and will instead stick with the truth, he said on Twitter. But thanks, though. The email sent, you know, I'm not going to give her name because she's probably going through a bad employee review process right now. But basically, it was sent by a White House communications staff member, argued there were myths being spread by Democrats about the phone call, which had triggered a media frenzy of false accusations, portrays a conversation between two leaders as entirely proper, and the handling of a related whistleblower complaint about the call as being absolutely by the book. The email also made reference to the deep state, a phrase that has fueled conspiracy theories of government bureaucrats working to undermine Trump. Sharing such messaging guidance with allies is common among both parties in Washington. What is not so common is sending those messaging guidance points to people that are your adversaries. That's a new tactic. People know how other people think, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's clear she should have just sent them to the Office of Special Counsel.
Yeah. Honestly, in this administration, these have been leaked before. I love how they just cut out the middleman and they just somebody there just gave up. They're like, all right, you know what? This is going to be a happy accident. Or someone there is just it just seems too perfect to be a mistake.
I tend to agree with that. I mean, it seems like it's, you know, too many stars aligning here.
So now we're talking about whistleblowers, obviously, and their relation with the hacking world and democracy and things like that. And it brings us back to one of our speakers at the HOPE conference, Edward Snowden, King Whistleblower, I guess you'd call him. And Kyle, I know you've been reading the book that just came out last week.
I got a copy. I think the other copies for the show got lost in the mail. But suffice to say, I was able to flip through. I read the preface in the first chapter.
It's really interesting. He talks about family and stuff just in the small sampling I've had, and it's interesting because we were able to meet part of, you know, some of his family when he spoke with us, and that was really exciting to read more about what his childhood was like. And it's just so cool. There's just a couple sections that
Edward Snowden as a child.
Yeah.
Imagine this.
He said, I don't want to give out too much because I'm sure a lot of people are reading this, but it is in the first couple pages, so I'm sure if anyone's picked it up, they've read it too, even out of curiosity. But he talks about being 6 years old and how his first taste of hacking and direct action had to do with bedtime. It was a little injustice, right? And he felt as though bedtime, watching his sister stay up, watching his parents stay up, why did they get to do it, but he couldn't? And after his sixth birthday, and he goes into detail, basically he didn't want the party to end and the celebration, and this is mm-hmm. a milestone, his milestone, and he had this thought that he could use direct action to get past this rule about bedtime that he totally disagreed with, and he went around and changed all the clocks in the house. And it was on the longest day of the year, so it worked. It absolutely worked. And I thought that was just an adorable and a brilliant, brilliant anecdote. Any hacker with a family would probably be able to relate, or yourself having grown up with crazy rules and little injustices, and you find ways when you're pressed like that.
Well, I mean, we used that trick to get an extra hour of the show last year, but I didn't think anybody else was actually trying that. Did he say how long he was able to get away with it for? Did he stay up till 4 a.m?
The next day, all the clocks were synchronized with his father's watch.
Well, you know what he should have done? He should have gotten up in the middle of the night and put them all back and just, you know, gotten an hour less sleep or something.
You got to, work on your footprints there. So I think that was great. And he also talks in the first part of a really beautiful section that I find really relatable about millennials and people that grew up in the 80s being the last generation that is not digitized, right? Like our heights were measured on door jams, these things that are falling out of fashion, you know, children are documented from birth, it seems, on these platforms, and you know, there's no part of your life that someone outside your family could just go back and read what happened on a given day, or see a picture or a story or a video of your emergence as a young person on into a adult human being. We didn't have that. We had privacy, relative privacy, from the digital age. And then we grew up around the emergence and along with this digital age. And I think he gets very kind of wistful and romanticizes it a little bit. And I, as someone who was born around the same time, I find that a very distinct thing and really beautiful the way he put it, that we're the last generation of humans to not have our upbringing digitized in nearly the same way and with the same breadth and scope as what young people grow up with now.
You know, there's a real misperception, though, about digitization and how permanent it is. I mean, you know, look up your Live Journal post and tell me how they're aging. You know, things get erased. Things disappear. And oftentimes, something that you think is going to be there forever isn't, because some server went down someplace, maybe the server that Trump is looking for. Who knows? But when you measured your height on a door jamb, well, that stayed as long as the house was there.
It's true. And he did he kind of described much of what has captured our upbringing as slowly deteriorating on formats like VHS and in negatives and photographs that eventually they kind of deteriorate over time. But it's also not searchable in the same way. Mm-hmm. So there's a distinction there that it does rot and degrade, but at the same time, it's not portable unless it is digitized, and unless and until it's vulnerable and not vulnerable in the same way as the systems that he was contracted with building had backups of themselves. So, there's all information and what was termed bulk collection, mm-hmm. all of that stored in one place, but he was building backups for that so that if one part of the U.S. gets completely flattened and leveled, there's a copy of it for whatever spooks remain. And that in and of itself is,
that's not people privately owning their stuff digitized. That's not even private companies owning that. That is straight up the government itself having bulk collected all information and all communications all the time and without permission, without a vote or consent from the creators. And that that's a really eloquent and I think an interesting way of essentially what pushed him to become a whistleblower.
Well, something else that will be deteriorating quite rapidly, I think, is are the profits from that particular book as well, because the Department of Justice is going after Snowden to disgorge all of the money that he would have made from the sale of that book, because he did not go through, and we're talking about channels tonight, he didn't go through the proper channels to get the information pre-reviewed before it was published.
But the six-year-old, I mean, you need to get that approved.
Not necessarily
that. That's why people are buying the book.
No, there are, well, let me ask you this. Yes. You know, you're a reasonable person. You're an egalitarian.
Let's go with that. Go ahead.
Do you think that all laws should apply equally to everybody?
It would be nice. I'd like to try it for a change, see what happens.
And that would apply to regulations as well, I would presume?
Well, it depends. I mean, regulations, you can make all kinds of rules and regulations, but are the rules and regulations just? I mean, you know, Trump is saying people have a non-disclosure agreement when they work for him in the White House, which is something that most people would not say is just.
Okay.
But yet it's enforced.
But they should apply equally to all, whatever the rules are, they should apply equally to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Snowden is a former federal employee. He used to work in the intelligence community, had access to top secret information. Anybody who has access to top secret information signs a secrecy agreement. I'm one of these people. I have the same disclosure and compliance obligations as Edward Snowden. If I were to publish a book that would touch on national intelligence classified information, I would have to submit that manuscript. And in fact, when I was at Oxford, my dissertation, before I gave it to my dissertation supervisor, I had to submit it to an agency in the intelligence community to have it pre-cleared.
But Alex, the difference is that what he's talking about is no longer a secret. It's been reported on many, many times.
Not necessarily. There could be things that he's going to write about that could still be classified. And that's the reason why pre-publication review exists in the intelligence community.
Has he revealed anything in this book that has not already been revealed?
We don't.
Well, if you read the book, you'd know.
Yeah. I just want to point out, he explicitly says at the end of the preface that nothing in his publication is about a specific system or technical thing that warrants, that is a big sort of top secret thing.
I understand that, but my point is that you need to have somebody with other access to classified information to validate that. We can't just take their word for it. Why should we take the word of Edward Snowden, somebody who stole massive amounts of information from the government, released it to the media? I don't deify him the way everybody else does. I have mixed feelings about him, obviously. But my point is, if that secrecy agreement would apply to me and Department of Justice could come and disgorge profits from my publications if I didn't go through the proper channels, I think they're right to do it to Edward Snowden. Look, everybody has to follow the rules. If he's a whistleblower, he's still a former federal employee. The rules still apply.
Do those rules include prison?
No.
Aren't they rules, though? Aren't they the same? Isn't that the penalty?
Well, I thought you were talking about pre-publication review rules. No, this is a civil thing. They can disgorge your profits if you don't follow those rules. But, you know, sure, he could be indicted. Oh, yeah, well, he would be, subject to confinement and prosecution if he were to come back in the United States. But he can submit his manuscript from afar. It wouldn't matter. And I think that he must have thought of this beforehand. This could not have come as a shock. So on the other hand, I do think it's laudable for him to go and publish the book, knowing full well that he won't be able to profit from it.
Well, this is what attorneys, I guess, Ben Wisner from the ACLU, says. This book contains no government secrets that have not been previously published by respected news organizations. Had Mr. Snowden believed that the government would review his book in good faith, he would have submitted it for review. But the government continues to insist that facts that are known and discussed throughout the world are still somehow classified.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter whatsoever. All right. You still have to go through that pre-publication review process. If you disagree with it, you can have a back and forth with that agency.
Could I write the book, though? Because based on what I've read in the newspapers?
Yes.
Only Edward Snowden can't write this book, but anyone else can write the book with the same facts.
Well, that anybody can write the book, but they have to submit it for pre-publication review.
I don't have to do that.
You don't have to do that. But you didn't have access to classified information, so they don't know that you're revealing something that you shouldn't be revealing.
This sounds like a real catch-22 conversation here. So you're saying that look, I can basically access newspapers and reports of things that Edward Snowden revealed and write a book about that, and I'm in the clear. But Edward Snowden can't do the exact same thing. Even though he is the source of the information, it became public afterwards. It just seems like maybe there's a different offense that he would be accused of. But
it's because
it can't be revealing secrets because they're no longer secrets.
It could be he's revealing secrets that he didn't previously reveal because he had access to a massive amount of classified information. And I mean, that's obvious from his disclosures.
But wouldn't they know just by reading the book that there are no new secrets here?
Yes.
So why don't they read the damn book and come to that conclusion?
Nobody gave it to him. That's exactly my point.
All right, so send them a book. Send them a book and this all can be resolved.
But the book has to be sent to them. A manuscript has to be sent prior to the publication.
Fine, get a time machine and we'll do it that way.
That's what you agreed to. You know, you sign up for that. And unfortunately, you know, it applies equally to everybody. Whether it's a prior restraint on freedom of speech is another issue.
We're going to have to leave it there. I wish we could go on for another hour or two.
Yep.
But great conversation. Write to us, oth@2600.com. We might be back next week. We're not sure. Fundraising time. All kinds of craziness happens around here. But keep listening, WBAI New York. It's awesome conversations going on all the time. We'll see you next week or the week after. Good night.
Write down this reminder to yourself. Saturday, the 16th of November. Yes, November 16th, 2019. An extraordinary experience will come your way. Prepare yourself.
Thanks to you.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Welcome to The Cutting Edge, where journalism, culture, politics, and activism converge. I'm Dred Scott Key.
Good old days were full of sunshine. Now they're full of rain.
Killer cops, police brutality, and mass incarceration have always been burning issues in Black America. But how did these problems develop? When did they begin? And who designed them? This roundtable discussion includes moderator Maxwell Cicato, author of Policing Los Angeles, Police Resistance, and the Rise of the L.A. Police Force, LaShawn Harris, author of Sex Workers, Psychics, and Numbers Runners, Black Women in New York's Underground Economy, and Naomi Murakawa, author of The First Civil Right, How Liberals Built Prison America. They look at both liberal as well as conservative support for expanding criminalization and punishment during and since the civil rights movement and the long struggle to challenge police brutality alongside Max Felker Cantor introduces the panel and himself.
There she goes.
My book, Policing Los Angeles, is a history of policing politics and anti-police abuse movements in Los Angeles from the 1965 Watts Uprising to the 1992 Los Angeles Rebellion, two of the biggest moments of urban civil unrest in the country's history. Separated by nearly three decades, these two events were my route into the main subjects of this book, the police and anti-police abuse activism, and the response of policymakers to demands for reform oftentimes. And I use these two moments of unrest as bookends, partially because, you know, in Los Angeles, they're the two kind of moments that stand out, but that they're both sparked by episodes of police abuse. In 1965, in August, during a routine traffic stop of a black motorist, in this case, a man by the name of Marquette Fry, and then his arrest and rumors of police brutality spread around the city. It leads to an outpouring of what I call anti-police protest that we all call the Watts Uprising, leading to 34 dead, 1,000 wounded, and 40 million in damages, and roughly 4,000 to 5,000 people arrested. This episode also leads to demands for change by activists, to diversify the officer corps, for more human relations training, for more community relations programs. But 27 years later, in 1991, after the beating of Rodney King, and the following year with the acquittal of the four officers who beat Rodney King, which was caught on video, Los Angeles goes up again in an anti-police protest in 1992. This time even bigger, 52 people at least were killed, thousands injured, 16,000 arrests. And this outburst leads to actually some significant reforms at both the city and federal levels, including legislation that expanded the ability of the Department of Justice to impose consent decrees, something used by the Obama administration to try to rein in police departments, but something that has actually been rolled back in the last few years. The beating of Rodney King and the reaction to it, if anything, I suggest, and I'll talk more about this, revealed how the police had become more powerful, more abusive, and more militarized, and more present in areas of social life where they had not been before. So between the 1960s and 1990s, in short, the police power had intensified. These two events, in many ways, pose a kind of fundamental question or paradox that I'll address tonight and that's in my book, and that is, how and why did the police power intensify after the Watts Uprising expose the racism at the heart of post-World War II policing and expose demands for change? And part of what might even be more paradoxical in some ways, and Naomi will get to this later, is that it occurs under the liberal administration of an African-American mayor named Tom Bradley. He had been a former police officer. He is elected, he goes into politics in 1963 as a city councilman. He's elected mayor in 1973, where he campaigned on a platform of police reform. He ultimately serves five terms. He's in office when the police beat Rodney King, and the following year when the jury acquitted the officers. The police force grew under Bradley's tenure, and so this is partially a story of liberalism and the expansion of police power. Bradley's policies, which he implemented over the course of two decades, aimed at procedural fairness, really by attempting to rein in discretion of officers on the street. And his belief that he could use the power of the mayor's office and the local government to oversee the police department while also supporting a law and order agenda, which enabled the expansion of the Los Angeles Police Department. And so such liberal approaches to trying to regulate law enforcement did little to actually question the fundamental role of the police in maintaining order, and released the LAPD to continue a campaign of repression, containment, and control. And this is Tom Bradley on the right side is Ed Davis, who was police chief in the 1970s, and then Daryl Gates on the bottom. This apparent paradox of police expansion under liberal reform leads to one of the key themes that I'm going to talk about, and that is of the police power and the ways the police organize politically to maintain their authority and independence from external oversight or accountability, especially from political officials, which I think is something that comes up all the way to the present. And so as the LAPD carved out its authority over more than three decades, they also attempted to produce and enforce a racially unequal social order through get tough practices. And in this way, the police constituted their own power through the crises they helped manufacture. What I mean by this is that their responses to urban uprising, to creation of moral panics about drugs and gangs in the 1980s, and challenges to their authority brought by activists. They used those moments as a means to mobilize and push for greater authority and power in the city. However, as I stress in the book, this leads to intense African American and Latinx discontent that repeatedly erupted in anti-police protest, most notably in 65 and 92, but also in everyday organizing by residents and activists to bring greater accountability and community control to the police. And this is a story of the 1960s with the Black Panthers and a number of other groups. But it's not only a story of the Panthers. It's also a story of groups like the Community Alert Patrol, which organizes after the killing of a Black man named Leonard Deadweiler in 1966 when he was driving his pregnant wife to the hospital. They organized to then follow the police and to observe arrests to attempt to bring accountability. It's also a story of Chicano activism in East Los Angeles with the Brown Berets, organizing and critiquing the police and the sheriff's department and their claims to protect and serve. And so this story continues, however, in that it's a story of organizing by everyday people and social movements, most notably in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s by an organization called the Coalition Against Police Abuse, which forms in 1976 and is active for 30 years. And they're engaged in a long uphill battle that resulted in a number of victories in Los Angeles, including dismantling the LAPD's intelligence division in the early 1980s. And they faced tremendous obstacles and resistance from the police to reforms, as the 92 unrest reveals. But they also produced the conditions for the possibility and vision for change for the future. And I'll get to that at the end. But part of what I think is so important about looking at some of these activists, and actually I'm going to stay there, is that, and Kappa in particular, is it allows us to create an alternative archive and narrative from state-sponsored ones, and to tell a story of policing and police power through the lens of those who were policed, rather than from the perspective of the police themselves. And emphasizing this point reveals the way that police power was adaptable and changed over time in response to pressures, but in ways that for those who are policed and continue to be policed, that policing oftentimes looked the same over time. And that's a story of repression, containment, and control. And so in some ways, this what I'm talking about tonight and what my book is about what did not change between 1965 and 1992, but it's also a story of social movements that repeatedly pushed for more accountable policing in their neighborhoods, community control of the police, themes and legacies we see today in movements like Black Lives Matter. And so the story I tell is about the relationship between police and politicians and activists, and it demonstrates that images of recent episodes of police shootings and killings that we might think of as new or not new at all. And the police resisted throughout this period all but the most limited demands for reform made by activists and residents. The police were able to organize politically and ensure their continued position of power within Los Angeles and other cities across the country, largely with the support of politicians and various interest groups. And so in short, there was a convergence of interests from across the political spectrum that worked to bolster police power, and the police became a powerful partisan entity in the city that we still see today, And with Tom Bradley and other liberals were oftentimes at the center of this story. And what they enabled is the LAPD's expansion of authority to become a model of policing for other police departments across the country. And so while I'm talking about Los Angeles, in many ways the story could easily be of any city in post-war America. And the LAPD was at the forefront of many innovations in policing and repression. And that can go from the adoption of anti-riot gear, which you see here, the establishment of the first SWAT team in the country in the late 1960s, to the militarized war on gangs and drugs in the 1980s, in this case where the LAPD used an armored vehicle with a 14-foot battering ram to smash in the house of a supposed rock house in Pacoima in 1985, and they found a mother and two children eating ice cream. The infamous Operation Hammer in 1989 that led to thousands of arrests of young men, primarily young men of color, who were then entered into gang databases. And so this story reveals the growth of police power under liberal administration, and that ultimately informed urban police policies after the 1960s. But despite the possibilities, as I conclude here, by the Watts Uprising and the 1992 Rebellion,